Welcome back to Preacher Handshake. I'm Evan.
And I'm Hannah, and we're your hosts.
This week on Preacher Handshake, it's our last episode before we take a little hiatus for the holidays, and it's a special one. We're talking about one of our own sermons. Hannah, we're going to be listening and learning from your preaching, and specifically your first sermon at your new congregation in Moscow, Idaho. You preached this message on September 28th, 2025. The sermon's called Cry Beneath the Table. And it comes from the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, found in Luke 16, 19 through 31.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm a little bit nervous. I didn't think I would be to have this conversation, but I'm a little bit nervous.
That's funny. I was too when we talked about mine, but it's an awesome sermon, and I can't wait to pick it apart with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I think, I've shared a bit about myself already. I know, but basically, I have started at this new church in September. We're listening to that first sermon today. But before then, I spent the last year in Edinburgh, Scotland, working on a master's in theology, researching and writing about collaborative preaching practices. And I've worked in college ministry and preaching. I've done writing, things like that. Yeah, so preaching is one of my big loves, and I don't know what else to say about myself, to be honest with you, but everyone here keeps asking me, like, where are you from? You don't really have like a dialect, but I'm from Texas. My family's still there. And now I'm in the middle of the rolling hills of the Palouse in Idaho.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. And we've worked together for a long, long time and have reviewed a lot of sermons together, and I'm glad that we get to do this today. And kind of big news during our hiatus time, or at least our hiatus from recording, is you're going to be back in Scotland. How come?
Yes, so I am graduating. So get to go walk the fancy stage at a really old building that I'm very excited about, and celebrate. I wrote a thesis that got approved, and so very excited to celebrate that. My family's gonna get to come and make it a
Wow.
whole celebration. Yeah.
That's so fun. Well, I hope that it goes really well. Enjoy Scotland, being back in Scotland. Have a haggis. Did you try haggis while you were there?
I did try haggis. It's better at some places than at others.
I would think, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't
Well,
hate it. That's the
it's on
consensus.
my bucket list. Well, as always, you can listen to Hannah's full sermon through the link in our show notes, and we're gonna dive in. So, as always, we're going to ask you this question, Hannah. What's your relationship to preaching?
Yeah, so preaching was kind of my call to ministry. So when I think about when I was discerning a call to ministry, it really first and foremost was a call to preach. I've always really loved language and crafting words, and especially the way that we think about language in being impactful for like a community or a group of people. That being said, I was really, really scared to preach. I always saw myself as somebody who, like, I like serving. I don't want to be the center of attention. I didn't want to be up front. I lean more introverted. And so that wasn't something I wanted to do, but I knew that I had like this passion and this desire to really see like scripture preached. And truthfully, it wasn't until I got my first opportunity to do it that I really said, okay, like, this is what I'm going to do. I don't know how you, Evan Duncan, found out that this is something I was considering doing, but then when you gave me this opportunity, the process of like crafting a sermon, I just really fell in love with. And then I remember the first time preaching, just like laying on the floor at the end of it, just being very exhausted and being like, ah, like this is the feeling, this is the thing. And so yeah, I've kind of really committed to doing this and to preaching, and I've written about it. I've talked a lot about it. I've preached a lot. And now, being in a pastoring role where I'm preaching a lot more frequently, I thought there would be a moment where I'm like, okay, I'm tired of this thing. But kind of the opposite has happened. And it sounds so cheesy when I say it. I told my friend this the other day, but like, even on the weeks when I'm like, I don't really want to preach this, I don't really want to do this, it feels like there's a million things getting in the way of the preparation. There's always a moment for me at some point in the process of preparing, delivering, where I still have like that, like, I get to do this. Like, this is cool. And like, it's still very fulfilling for me.
I don't remember either. I think you were like a freshman or maybe a sophomore the first time you preached. But do you remember what year were you in school?
Maybe a sophomore.
It was early. And
It was early.
I knew you were like studying Christian studies. I don't know. I don't know. But I remember that first sermon, and I remember being like, this is part of me was frustrated that I had spent so much time in school and done so much work, and was like, I think she that is the best sermon I'm going to hear in a while, because you were so clearly gifted and poured so much of yourself into it, and such a gifted preacher, and I'm so grateful for this long history of collaboration we have now. So tell us more about your context today, the context for this sermon. Who's your congregation? What are they like?
Yeah, so the United Church of Moscow is an American Baptist and Disciples of Christ congregation. They're dually aligned. These two churches merged together in the 70s, and they kind of keep this distinct tradition alive. It skews older, it's a small congregation, but they're very active, very justice oriented. And when I was considering coming to be their pastor, I was asking questions like, what do you love about your church? What are things that you really appreciate about it? And I consistently heard just care and love for the community. And there was one guy in particular that I'll remember. I asked him, like, what do you love about your church? And he is, this 70-year-old man, near 80-year-old man, who just immediately said, I love that trans people feel welcome here. And then, like,
Yeah.
I asked another guy the same thing, like, what do you think our church can be like about? Like, what do you think the church needs to be for? And again, this old man just immediately was like, I think we need to be an alternative to Christian patriarchy, that we need to be a place where like women feel supported. And I was like, these people are so cool.
Yeah.
Like, and so since I've been here, like, that's just grown, the love they have for people. So.
That's awesome. Tell us about your sermon prep process. What's it typically like?
Yeah, so I think I'm still trying to find kind of my rhythm of doing this more frequently, but on Monday I'm trying to kind of just read over the text a whole bunch in a lot of different translations, thinking through what's emerging from the text, thinking about like kind of what big themes are happening, and then I start kind of doing like the bare like exegesis, so thinking really what is this text trying to say in its original context. Sometimes I'm pulling out commentaries on Monday. Sometimes I'm just like trying to really listen and dig in from what I know. On Tuesday, there's a group that I meet with over Zoom that is area pastors who are all following the lectionary together. And so we talk through the text together on Tuesday mornings, which has been a lot of fun. And these are all people from like lots of different traditions. So I'm getting lots of different input and feedback from them. And that really forms the foundation of like, I walk away from that meeting going like, okay, I know kind of where I'm going. And then from there, I'm planning our liturgy, things like that. Wednesday is a lot of thinking through what are the kind of major movements of it. And then on Thursday, I sit down and I write it. And my goal is by like end of day Thursday, I've got a good, this is what I'm doing. Sometimes if I feel like I need to sit back and look at it again, I'll pull it out again on Saturday. I don't look at it at all on Friday. That's kind of my big commitment. Give it a day to rest. And then Sunday, I run through it a couple of times before I preach.
Awesome. So this is your first sermon at the first church where you're serving as the lead pastor. So lots of firsts going on here. And you're using the lectionary, as you mentioned. So you're kind of at the mercy of the lectionary a little bit. And you mentioned that, and I want to play a clip from that, from the beginning of your sermon.
But you can imagine my surprise when I opened the lectionary this week and found out that the first sermon I would be preaching to you all was based on this text. This doesn't seem like great source material for an inaugural sermon. It's a bit of a downer. In fact, I remember the first time that I heard this text preached as a kid. It gave me nightmares for weeks. Because, see, I read the story and was taught the lesson, be kind, lest you be damned to hell, this place of eternal conscious torment where you're forced to forever see heaven and it's so far away and you can't even get a drink of water. That's a harsh lesson for a kid. It's a harsh lesson for anyone, really.
So, for a reminder for listeners, if you missed it at the beginning, this is a sermon on the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. As you're taking in this text and thinking about preaching to this people that you're getting to know, but I mean, effectively, you've known through an interview process, you're clearly connecting, you can hear it in the room, but what's going on in your mind as you're preparing? How did you know that you knew enough about them to begin with this concept of hell, and your own misgivings about engaging with this text or past with this text?
Yeah, well, in some ways it was unavoidable, right? Because I mean, as I shared, like I read this text and immediately I'm 10 years old, scared to death of like the rapture or something. And this was like something that for a kid was a really scary story for me. And even as an adult, as I'm thinking about like deconstructing what I believe about like heaven and hell and the afterlife, this was one of those like pivotal texts for me. So in some ways it was unavoidable. That was what was running through my mind. And also the text starts that way, right? Like it paints this picture. And I think often the way this text is preached is very much like, let's talk about the cosmic afterlife. So in some ways it was unavoidable. I felt like I had to address the elephant in the room. And then I felt like as I've been getting to know the people, I felt like there were a lot of people who, you know, they're very progressive. And I think there was a lot of people who maybe have kind of doubts or questions about what they've been taught or about maybe what they've heard about the afterlife or about hell. But they don't really know how to articulate it. They don't really know why they feel uncomfortable with it. They just know they feel uncomfortable with it. And so I tried to be able to approach it in a way that wasn't like spelling out my theology, wasn't giving them all the answers, but was kind of opening up the conversation to say, like, it's okay if we have questions about this, and let's pivot and think about a different approach to it. So, not being overly prescriptive about it, but giving people maybe permission to explore the fear that they have, and to give some fresh perspective to a text that I think is often held hostage to this like end times rhetoric. I wanted to really free the text to say something else.
Yeah, it was super disarming to like just name, and I find that often, like when we can name the tension or the things people are feeling, all of a sudden everybody kind of takes a breath, you know, and it's, you don't have to be on the defensive as much. So you do this great work of disentangling this parable with the thoughts of the afterlife, and then help your congregations reframe onto the big idea of the actual parable. So I want to share another clip.
If we release ourselves from trying to draw conclusions about the afterlife and instead turn our attention to the main point of the parable, perhaps we can begin to hear the cry coming from beneath the table. See, in this story, we meet a man named Lazarus, who's described in a few small ways. Economically, he's very poor. Likely homeless or close to it. Physically, he's sick. He's covered in sores. Psychologically, he is tormented, begging for the bare minimum for scraps falling from a table. This characterization, although it's brief, is what we might expect from somebody in his desperate situation. In 2024, the CDC published a report linking homelessness to an increased number of health problems. Unhoused people have an increased risk for infectious and non-infectious diseases. They commonly face mental illness, alcohol and substance abuse disorder, diabetes, heart and lung disease.
Further, the CDC reports that unhoused people have a significant structural and social barrier to healthcare and other social services, which worsens their health outcomes, often resulting in severe illness and death.
So I love how you kind of reframe Lazarus, and just by bringing in like, what are the details? What do we know about him? And then you take us from the then to the now of imagining what people around us who are in similar situations are experiencing, and what's that like? I want to know where that idea came from. I'm jumping to the CDC, and then how it would have how you hope that it would be received by your context.
Yeah, I think I really wanted to make Lazarus real. I think sometimes we have a habit of, when we talk about parables, just being like, oh, it's just a story. Like, these are just people that are disconnected. And I think, especially as I kind of bring out later on, like, Jesus is very particular about the way he talks about Lazarus. Like, we're given a very descriptive image of who he is. And so I wanted to make that really concrete for people to not think about him and his condition in the abstract, but to really not just be like this guy that's disconnected from reality, but someone that we could see on our street, someone that we know, like to really kind of put flesh on him. And I thought that this would be a really great connection for the people in my church because, as I've said, like I'm still getting to know them, but one of the things that's immediately apparent is like how much they care for the community. We have like a food pantry. There's people in my congregation who are working with lots of nonprofits. One of my congregants is helping a nonprofit that is specifically working with the unhoused in our community. And so this is on their minds. This is on their hearts. They see these people, they know these people. And so I really wanted to connect with them in that way to say, like, this is somebody tangible. This is not just something that we can say, oh, that was a Bible story a long, long time ago about a fictional guy. Like, this is someone we know. So I thought that would be really helpful for them.
Yeah, I think it did really good work. And you're also using this image, this cry beneath the table. You used it there. You're going to use it throughout the message. It made me think of Jesus in that difficult passage talking to the woman, where he's talking about throwing scraps before dogs from the table. And at some point, that made me a little bit uncomfortable too, just because that passage is difficult. Why did you decide on that scraps at the table? And that's what you say, right? The cry beneath the table. Where did that table language come from? And why did you think it would be helpful in this sermon?
So I'll give you the truthful answer
Yeah.
first, which is I was trying to come up with a catchy sermon title,
Okay.
which is new for me. So I like normally when I preach in every context I've been before, sermon titles are not really a big thing here, but here it's very central. Like we print it on the bulletins, it's like front and center. So it's like something that people remember. So I knew that there had to be. It had to be memorable for people. I wanted it to communicate something about what the message was going to say. And I struggle sometimes to come up with that. But I was thinking about these themes that were emerging of like justice and justice denied and the privilege that we have. And through that was thinking about this image of the table. I've been really fascinated with that image a lot. I think it's applicable in a lot of contexts, right? So like in society, we think about like the table as being this like the seat of power. Where is the places, the tables that we have? I
Yeah.
think like we talk about it a lot as, you know, who are the people who are not invited to the people who don't have a seat at the table, things like that. And then I think we also see it in scripture a lot, like specifically in Luke, where this text is found, Jesus is eating and drinking and just moving from table to table to table throughout Luke. And it's interesting to see the people who like are invited, who are included, who are maybe not a part of it throughout. Like, I think there's really interesting images happening there. And so I was thinking about all of this as like an image of a table, and then thinking about like Lazarus is really like somebody who's begging for the scraps that are falling from the table. Like, that's what the text says, is like he's begging for table scraps. And so thinking about using this language to talk about like the table representing a source of power or a source of privilege or a source of like who's in. And then as a way to contrast, like, well, who's not included in that? Who's left out of that? Who is begging for the table scraps, whether that is from our physical table or from these tables of authority and power. So I found that to be a really fascinating and useful image here.
Yeah, I think it works, and I like how it works on so many levels. And I also hate sermon titles. Like, that's a really hard part of it for me. And sometimes I'm just so boring with them. But I do think a good one can be really helpful and really sticky. And to be able to, like, open a if you leave your bulletin in your Bible, if you're using paper bulletins, to like see the sermon title and it stick and you remember is really powerful. I need to think more about how well I'm doing at that. I also want to talk to you about how you talk about sin. Because both of us know what it's like to be in a context where we really only ever hear sin talked about on like individual aspects, right? Everything is a hard issue, and thus systemic sin and systemic change are really never considered. Like, that's a very common approach in, like, kind of evangelical spaces to talk about sin. On the other side of that coin, though, is an emphasis only on systemic sin, right? And systemic injustice. And then, like, the personal aspect, personal sin, is something that can be overlooked, ignored, waved off. And so, as you've shifted contexts pretty dramatically, how do you seek to hold attention of those things in your preaching, right? How do you think of your preaching changing, moving from one context where maybe talking about systemic sin is really challenging for people, and then to another where maybe talking about individual sin would be really challenging to people, but at the same time, maybe bringing triggers. I don't know. Like, how do you think about that? How are you thinking about how you're going to talk about sin in your context?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a big question. It's funny, in the sermon or in the pastor search process, they at first, like even before they agreed to have a like Zoom meeting with me, had kind of a list of like, here are some theological questions of like things that they wanted to make sure we were on the same page about. And one of those things was like, what do you believe about sin? Like they just asked me straight up. And I kind of had to do this, like, I want to be really honest. And I think that this is a big tension, especially for more progressive contexts where we do focus a lot on systemic sin. And I love that because I think it was a big part of like theology that was missing for me just in like my background. And so it's nice to have kind of that emphasis and to think about who we are as a community and who we want to be as a group of people. But I also don't think that should come at the expense of like losing the particulars and knowing the fact that like we are all still in process. So I think one of the ways I try and balance it is my preaching, I think, sometimes does focus more on communal sin because I'm speaking to a community. So I want to be able to help people think about the way that's shaping us as a people. But I'm trying to, in other ways, through like we do a prayer time every part of our service, to have a moment in every part of the service, whether it's during prayer, whether it's communion, where I am asking people to think about like what are the ways that you still need to be transformed. And so thinking, having moments like that throughout the service, I think are important. And then also I think talking about like personal sin in light of the fact that like we are still good and beautiful and valued creation, right? So, like, we can still say, yes, we are still in need of the grace of God. We are still in need of being transformed. Like, we are still in process. And also, at no point does that negate the fact that God calls us good, that like we are loved. And I think holding those two together is a key piece for me. That makes me feel better about like, let's talk about sin personally, but let's not lose sight of the fact that like, this doesn't mean that you're the worst of the worst of the worst. And that I think is a helpful guideline I try and use.
Yeah, I think you're right on. I think I think part of the reason that maybe personal sin doesn't show up in more progressive spaces in conversation and in preaching is that thing, right? Is because there's a need to not communicate you're terrible, you're a spider dangling by a thread over a flame kind of stuff that is so that can be so damaging. But there, if the reaction of it goes so far, then all of a sudden, like, we're not actually helping people be responsible for like their need for transformation and their complicity even in systemic sin, as individuals, as what they're engaging with. So anyway, I think you're doing an awesome job in this sermon of bringing some of those things forward, but it's something I'm wrestling with. So after this like reflection on Lazarus, you bring in the rich man and you do it alongside the background of the Pax Romana or the Peace of Rome. So I want to hear that clip.
The national ideology of the day was called the Peace of Rome. It perpetuated the idea that under Roman rule, things were fair and just. And if you were just obedient to Rome, if you put your trust in their system, then prosperity would come for everyone. They believed this so much that when Rome would go and conquer or colonize new places, they would call it the good news of Rome, the gospel of the emperor. So just keep your head down, assimilate well, become a model citizen, be obedient, and things will work out for you. It makes sense then that when we meet the rich man living under the good news of Rome, the gospel of the emperor, that he seems neither to question his own status nor to be very concerned with the status of others. After all, he's worked hard for the things he has. Within a system that is fair and just, it is unthinkable that someone would ask for a seat at his table or even for his table scraps. Because obedience to the empire promises peace and prosperity and protection. So if someone has a lower status than him, they must have done something to deserve it. Who are they to ask for a seat at his table, for a bite of his food, for a job that is his, for opportunities that he's been given? The rich man believes this so much that he doesn't even question it in death. Notice in verse 24, he asks Lazarus to bring him water. And in verse 27, he asks that Lazarus would be sent to his brothers. Even in death, he assumes that Lazarus has lived a life worthy only of a servant.
Okay, there's so much good richness going on there. I mean, it's like layers and layers and layers of theology and psychology and all these things. But I had never read this story and thought of the rich man and his request to Lazarus having so much social baggage or assumptions of superiority. Where did that idea come from? Like, where'd you find it? Was it your reading? Was it a commentator, a scholar? I mean, I loved it. I love when we find something that you're like, oh, I see this in a whole new light. Where'd that come from? And how did it help you then kind of figure out how you're going to preach this passage?
Yeah, so I think one of the ways I approached this passage was, in the same way that I was trying to kind of make Lazarus come to life, I was also trying to think through the character of the rich man. And so the way that I did it was I first kind of looked at everything Lazarus said or did, and then looked at everything the rich man said or did. And when I kind of separated the rich man out and was looking at him as just a character, this kind of like, at no point in the story does he ever think that he's wrong. Like,
Yeah.
he just never gets there. And in my mind, I find that so hard to understand. Like, I just started asking, like, how do you not see? Like, how, like, even in death, how do you not get it? And then I started thinking about, well, what are the reasons maybe that he didn't? And I kind of fell upon this of like, well, maybe he just assumed that he was right. Like, if you don't understand, you have to be operating in a worldview that assumes you are correct. And so I kind of started thinking about that. And then I was reading, was having a conversation and kind of with like other commentaries and things like that. And this theme of like, yeah, like the idea that somebody was begging, the reason why it was so bad was not even just because like they were poor, but because like systemically they would say you've done something to deserve it. And that, like, in a system that prides itself on like being fair, being poor means you've done something against the system and you deserve it. So like there's a lot of systemic things going on here, so it makes sense why people in power would assume it's deserved. Because if you've believed in the order, the structure, then like you're able to think even in death, you've done nothing wrong. So that was kind of the inception and a little bit of the thinking through it. But this was a big moment for me to be like, okay, if the point of this text is not the afterlife, what is the point of it? And this for me felt like a really good place to like pitch my tent.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. At one point, you start to get really nerdy, and I love it. You start to quote Andor, which I think all Christians need to watch Andor. So that's my Andor plug for the day. It has made my sermons many a time. So I want to listen to that clip.
In the Star Wars television series, Andor, there's one character named Nimic who describes the difficult reality of fighting back against the injustices of an oppressive empire. And he says this: "There will be times when the struggle seems impossible. I know this already. Alone, unsure, dwarfed by the scale of the enemy. Remember this: the day will come when all of these skirmishes and battles and these moments of defiance will have flooded the banks of the Empire's authority, and then there will be one too many. One single thing will break the siege. Remember this: try. Keeping our hearts turned toward oppression and bent towards justice is a struggle that seems impossible, especially in the face of insurmountable evil, in the face of oppression that seems to never end. But notice Jesus' strategy for fighting the empire. This is not the story of the rich man and the poor man, no. This is the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Unlike the empire, which paints with broad strokes, bluntly categorizing people, reducing human life to mere statistic, Jesus calls Lazarus by name. Lazarus is not some caricature of a pervasive condition. No, Lazarus gets a name and a face and a story. In fact, Lazarus is the only person that Jesus ever names in a parable.
There's so much, so good. I love the use of pop culture. I'm curious, like, do you feel like Andor was something your congregation, like, you're like, I know I have some people familiar with, or you're like, I don't know if I have anybody familiar with this. I don't know if that ever comes into your mind as I think about using pop culture references. I sometimes wrestle with that, and I don't know, and it feels like media is more diverse than ever. So that was my first part of the question. Like, when you're choosing a piece of art to use, how are you thinking about how it engages with your people and their background with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. My congregation is older, so I knew they would know Star Wars, maybe not Andor in particular. But there is also kind of this weird niche, like college group that's been coming. And even though this was my first Sunday, this is one of the most, like, I have people who ask me about this sermon pretty much every week. And I have a couple of college people in particular who talk about how like they've had the conversations with their friends about this and how much they love this. and I'm convinced that talking about Star Wars is what made them come back. So,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think I'm kind of trying to balance this thing, being a pastor who's like young, but in a congregation that is older, of like, I want to be authentic to like my experience and also to meet them where they are. So, like, how do we have this thing of like, this is really relevant, but if they don't even understand the context, it's not helpful for them. So, I think I'm trying to find ways to like connect with them in a way that is accessible, even if they don't immediately know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I think you did a great job of like framing it. I remember like doing college ministry, I would often use tons of pop culture, but I would also like introduce hundreds of year old paintings, you know? And so you have to figure out
Right.
like how can I bring something to them that may be new and that actually may help them see something in a whole new light. So I thought that was really cool. And then I just love this strategy that you bring forth, you know, when this concept is just so daunting and the problem seems so scary. And you mentioned this sermon, you know, Jesus says the poor will always be among you. Like, well then, like it feels so big. And you bring forth this strategy of battling the empire with particularity and this illumination of Lazarus' name, which I had never thought about, that that's the only name given in a parable. Theologians call the incarnation a scandal of the particular. And to think about like, yeah, that's what God does all the time. It's just like direct attention. Lazarus has a name. I never thought of it that way. Where'd that come from for you? And yeah, how did it help you as you were crafting?
Yeah, so again, like I wanted to make Lazarus very real because I think Jesus makes him very real. But I think, especially when I framed the rich man's kind of condition, his problem, as being like a believer in the empire, the response to that is not, let's go build a bigger, better empire. It's, let's notice the people who are left out of this empire. Let's notice the people who are not included, who are crying beneath the table. And like, that's how we win, quote unquote. Like, I used this quote to say, like, it's the little things, because like our tools for resistance of a culture that doesn't acknowledge people beneath the table, so to speak, is not to then try and outdo them in that way. It's to notice the people. And I think I grew up hearing kind of this thing in my generation, especially of like, you're going to change the world, right? Like, we were told, like, we're going to change the world and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not. But I do believe that, like, as a follower of Christ, I can have an impact in so and so's life, and I can mean something for this community. And like our church here, we're not gonna change the entire American cultural landscape, but I don't think we're called to. And so having to give that as a piece of hope to people is like, no, you maybe are not gonna be able to do all the things you wanna do. You maybe aren't gonna change the world. But I don't think that's what God is calling you to. And for Lazarus, for the Lazaruses in our life, that means everything.
Yeah, it's so good. There's a scene in, I think it's The Last Jedi, which I'm a big fan of that one, and then it kind of all falls apart after that. But in
Yeah,
the end
you
of the,
calling me a nerd is rich, by the
I
way.
know, I'm saying it's not supposed to be an insult, it's a appreciation. So in the end of The Last Jedi, though, there's this like scene, it's like maybe my favorite moment of the new movies for sure, where like after all of the whatever happens, there's just like these kids who are like inspired and excited, right? And for these like outcast kids who are marginalized, all of a sudden have this like bit of hope. And I mean, I totally see that in what's happening in this in your sermon is helping us just offer that hope for and find hope for ourselves that we can make an impact, but also hope for the people beneath the table. Yeah, it was really fun, really interesting. So here are our closing questions. We ask everybody these, as you know, because I think you wrote them. What are you most proud of this sermon?
Yeah, I proud that I said what I said. Being in the church I'm in has been a really unique and fun and challenging space because I feel like I've been in context before, pretty much most of my preaching context, where I felt very scared to say what I felt and what I believed. And I felt like I was kind of trying to thread a needle oftentimes. And I don't feel that here. And so I think I'm just really proud that, like, I said what I felt needed to be said, and I didn't shy away from that. And that makes me, like, really proud and gives me a lot of hope for, like, what me being a pastor in this church could look like.
Cool. What would you do differently if you could redo it?
I think I would have practiced it a few more times. I don't usually get nervous when I preach. But I was a little nervous this time as my first one. And I
Sure.
wasn't prepared for how like nervous I was gonna feel. So like I think if you're used to hearing me preach, you can hear the nerves in my voice and I
Yeah.
could definitely feel it. And so I think I would have just done it a few more times to feel a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's anything you could have done to remove the nerves that were going to be there, because how do you preach in a new? I mean, I remember my first time preaching in this congregation too. It was like I've preached to way more people,
Yeah.
but for some reason, like because this is the place that's called me, and it's my first time of whatever this is going to be together, it's nerve-wracking, and you don't know it, and you can't prepare for it till you're in it. All right, here's the big question. Why do you think preaching matters today?
Yeah, when we started this podcast, this is a question I think I wanted to ask preachers because it was a question I was really struggling to answer myself, to be honest. When we started this, and for the last like year, I was living in another country and I was kind of taking a break from just like being in ministry. And I was really having a lot of questions about like, do I want to continue doing this? Is this what I want to do? Why does this work even matter? Right? Like, I love it, but is it meaningful? And I really didn't have an answer for a little while. And then being abroad during 2024 and 2025 and watching the political religious landscape of America shift really dramatically while I had basically no power to do anything about it was really difficult. And in particular, I found myself really, really grieved by the way Christians were being portrayed and the way Christians were acting, frankly. And it became really clear to me that, like, the things we believe about God and about our relationship to God and about our relationship to one another deeply impacts everything we do. It impacts the way that we're voting. It impacts, like, who we're advocating for. It impacts how we're loving people, who we're choosing to engage with. And if the church relegates that to some other voice, then we've lost our ability to be this like alternative community that scripture really preaches about. And so, in a way, like, I think preaching matters because what we believe about God and one another matters. And the story that we are telling ourselves about who we are matters. And preaching is, I think, a unique way in which we are reminding ourselves and encouraging ourselves and letting ourselves be formed by Christ and not by culture, first of all. And I think that that's why it matters.
Thanks for listening to our conversation with Reverend Hannah Brown. If you want to keep up with Hannah, her work, or listen to her full sermon, check out the links in our show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and follow us on whatever platform you get your podcast and share with your friends. You can keep up with all things Preacher Handshake on our Instagram at Preacher Handshake, or email us your questions or preacher recommendations at preacherhandshake@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Have a meaningful Advent and a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year.